knows the evil that lurks in the hearts of men. Only the shadow knows. Yes, the evils that lurk in the hearts of men. The fears. Yes, the fears of those dark flying objects. Those long, twisting, mysterious passages. The thickly drifting dust of the ages. Green scarabs shining dimly in the dark. Ancient cobwebs. The smell of musty, worn stones. The rustle of leaves. The sighing of wind through Gothic naves. What are you afraid of? What are we all afraid of? Where are those sounds we hear? Those smells we smell, and those suspicions we suspect. Those things in the hedgerows. That's it, Charlie. Good boy. No, out. No, out. Just watch me. Just watch me. When I go like that, that means out. You know, what are the things that we're afraid of, really? I mean, the real things. Do you remember the days when we used to be... there are certain things that all people are afraid of. They have nothing to do with the Russians. Have nothing to do with political theories. Don't even have anything to do actually with actual enemies. Things, you know what I mean? Things. I remember one time I'm a kid. Oh, boy, I'll tell you, there have been some times when I have been scared right out of my tennis shoes. I'll tell you. I mean, really scared. And very rarely have these times ever been with anything tangible. I mean, tangible like, you know, you see another kid's going to bop you or something like that. This is not the kind of stuff you really get terrified of. I remember one time on a Saturday afternoon, I'm this kid, see, and it was one of the very first times that I ever experienced absolute, complete, abject, fantastic horror, terror, screaming memes. You know, the real thing. I tell you, I had nightmares for about a month after this, and it occasionally still haunts me on streets when I'm way downtown at 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm a kid, you know, and every Saturday afternoon you go to the show. You know, you go to the show. And they had things like they'd have cowboy pictures. They'd have once in a while they'd have a triple feature. You know, once in a while they'd throw in a love story, which is terrible. We'd sit there and yell and holler and fist fight all the way through the love story, and then they would come out with another cowboy picture and everything's okay for a while, and then occasionally they'd have the thing they call a horror picture. Well, horror pictures never did scare you. I mean, not really. They're just sort of funny. There's monsters running around and hollering. Well, one afternoon for the horror picture, they had this picture. I'll tell you, and I'm prepared for horror pictures. I know how to handle things from the outer depths and all that sort of stuff. And I mean, that kind of stuff is kind of funny, you know? King Kong hanging on the top of the Empire State Building, knocking down Spads, was not really scary. And I must say, no, there was a little bit too much. King Kong was kind of like an early Anthony Quinn. So You couldn't, that's right, you couldn't get really mad at King Kong or scared or anything. He was just, you felt sorry for him. At the same time, you wanted him to make the scene with Fay Wray, you know? You couldn't really get mad at King Kong. So that wasn't the kind of thing that scared you. But let me tell you, this picture came on, oh boy. It started out, it was very unsuspecting. It was just a kid, you know, it was just a horror picture. And they had finished some Bob Steele picture or something, and the Western guys go galloping off into the distance, and they had dealt with that crummy sheep ranching crowd that were about to ruin the range for the good guy. And the daughter and the whole business was gone. The newsreel came on. The kids are yelling and hollering, hitting each other and eating the popcorn and stuff. And you can smell the gum and the sweat and the fielder's mitts. And you smell all that. You know, the kids never... there's a funny smell about kids. It's sort of a half like sour milk, like sweat. But it's a different kind of a sweat. It's not the same kind of sweat that people have. It's, you know, it's kid sweat, you know. It's a very different kind of sweat, and the kids are not aware of this. I was sitting around and sweating and hollering, and everything's going. And suddenly the newsreel is over, and on came this music. Charlie, do you have this music here? The first thing we played. No, not that one. No, number one. That's it. This music came on, and they had the credits. And you could see there was a long shot. And the long shot was through what looked like, oh, I'll tell you, one of the things that we're all afraid of. Bring it on there, just quietly behind me, just quietly. It's the kind of stuff they're playing. This was not King Kong, you know. At first, you know, the kids are sort of itching and they're watching. But there is a long, dark shot through what looked like the most unbelievably ancient, scary, terrible, cobweb-ridden attic that went on and on and on and had great, high, cavernous ceilings, went high and high and high up. And then way at the far end of that closet, that enormous, unbelievable, gothic attic, you could see a tiny, hunched figure, and he's sitting over an organ. You could just see him from behind with great dark shadows looming over him and a candle flickering next to him. And he's playing this organ. And it was a hunched figure, I'll tell you, a hunched figure, an insane figure, wearing what looked like medieval leather clothes, all hanging down in darkness with a guttering candle next to him. Take it out, Charlie. It scares me even now. Well, I am sitting there, and I'm with these kids, you know, and you should have heard the pall that fell over that crowd of insane maniacs. About 30 seconds after the credits went by, there was not a sound in the house, and I doubt whether there was one pair of dry pants. It was incredible. I'll tell you, it was incredible. It was really something. I cannot describe it to you. I'll award the brass figurine with bronze oak leaf palm to anyone who can tell me the name of that picture. Well, it went on and on and on. It got more gothic, and about every 30 seconds, you'd see this little hunched figure. He's climbing higher and higher. I remember one scene, higher and higher. He's climbing into what looked like, it was the bell tower. He's climbing higher and higher, and you can see way down below him the lights of Paris. And as he gets into this ancient bell tower, you can see great cobwebs, insane cobwebs, that were like 40 feet across. Dust was slowly settling, and then you could hear the sound. Great bats are flying. Enormous dark shadows, fluttering wings. And he grabs these bells. Oh, stop, Charlie. Stop. Oh, stop, Charlie. Cut it out. Oh, boy. Whew. Well, I'll tell you, it was something. That picture went from... it started out... Well, it went from bad to worse. You've heard that expression. And then it went to worser. Then it went to insanely worse. And then finally it went to complete maniacal nuttiness. It was all out. And you could see that stage down there. Oh. I will award the brass big the gee if you can tell me the name of that picture. No, sir, I'm not going to tell him. I don't want to scare anybody just by mentioning it. Showing it, I bet they don't dare show it on television. They wouldn't dare show it on television, I'll tell you. I cannot imagine a Mr. Clean commercial in the middle of that gothic horror. I just cannot. Impossible. I can just see after that shot in the bell tower and the bats, they cut away and then they say, "Woo! Mr. Clean with the Grime Fighters." Oh, stop it. Yeah, and the little white tornado, the whole jazz, it would never work. And that girl that comes on that's having the love affair with a bar of soap. Sad how many people have to look for everything for happiness. But believe me, that picture was, it dealt with what we could call basic horrors. You know what are called basic horrors? The fear of the thing. Well, now, just the thing.
I know what I said.
Don't think for a minute. And any time anybody ever shows you the thing, it never works out well. Just the thing. The thing is the thing that we're all afraid that is hiding in the back of those closets. That's what the thing is, whatever it is. It's also in the bottom there, way down in the holds of ships at 2 o'clock in the morning. It's the thing that is up the dark alleys. It's the thing, it has many, many variations. It's like a crawling, did you see a couple of weeks ago they had a series of commercials on the air for what looked like a just horrendously bad movie. But there was one thing that they had, Charlie. It was a crawling hand. We are afraid of disembodied hands, among other things. Oh, yes. Disembodied means a hand without a body. In fact, we are afraid of anything that's disembodied. Can you imagine being chased by a disembodied foot? That's pretty scary right there. Sure, the famous Ichabod Crane story is an example of dealing with the eternal terrors. The eternal, and nothing to do with the Russians. And they're afraid of the same thing. You see, the thing that I'm making here is that these are universal fears. These scare the Russians, it scares the Chinese, it scares everybody. The Eskimos break out in a cold sweat when they think, yes, it's a cold sweat they break out into. Maybe it's a hot sweat if you're an Eskimo, I suppose you're right. But you know, the thing that we are afraid of, no one knows. No one knows what it is. And once in a while, speaking of fear, this is WOR AM and FM New York. Excuse me, madam. And, Some guys work in fear as a medium. I'm talking about authors, and have succeeded very well in creating it. The natural horrors. You know what's another one of our natural horrors? And I hate to tell you this, you know, I just certainly comes as no surprise, but one of our natural horrors always has been other races. People always suspect that other races, whatever the other race is capable of supernatural powers of one kind or another. This has been an age-old thing. That it runs through literature as far back as you can go. That even today, when we talk about, say, colored people, for example, there's all kinds of myths about them. That they have a natural sense of rhythm, you know, that kind of stuff. Or they're more sexy. All of these, all this mythical stuff goes on. It's all supernatural. It's a kind of magic. And that invariably, too, there is the belief that the other race, whatever it happens to be, this other race, and I'm sure that other races have a feeling, say if you're a member of the Caucasian race, they have feelings about us that must be supernatural. I don't know. But I'm sure they do. But if you go, you'll find that one of the great fears is the other race. And this has a great deal to do, you know, with a lot of the problems that are going on in the world today, whether we want to admit it or not. It definitely is there. The vague belief of the supernatural in the other crowd. In fact, many authors have used this theme. It's worked in and out of fiction for thousands and thousands of years. It pops up even in modern fiction today, and people read it without even knowing that they're being concerned with that thing. Did you ever read Dr. No by Ian Fleming? Absolutely. Right down the line. Right down. In fact, Fleming really writes in that traditional genre of the mysterious fear of other races. If you notice that James Bond is always dealing with sinister Orientals. Invariably, he's dealing with strange Burmese who are growing plants that are unknown to herbologists. You know, and they're always doing something. Well, one of the greatest masters of that genre, as a matter of fact, I'll tell you, he's probably the man who set the whole pattern of the universal fear. Say, to digress for a moment, you know, the horror novel, the genuine horror novel, is one of the rarest forms of writing. It's even rarer than humor. And when I'm talking about the genuine horror novel, I'm not talking about the mystery. I'm not talking about the mysterious hatchet murder case. None of that stuff. I'm talking about the horror novel, the gothic horror tale. If you're interested in reading a classic gothic horror tale, now, it's not gothic in the sense of set in a gothic period, but it's somewhat gothic in its outlook. Read Shirley Jackson's The Haunting of Hill House. Boy, that is a gasser, I'll tell you. That's a true... I'll guarantee you that you pick that thing up, and if you're in the pad and it's 2 o'clock in the morning, believe me, Charlie, cold sweat, hot sweat, there's going to be more sweating and more people afraid to get up and go in the next room. The Haunting of Hill House. It is one of the most frightening books I have ever read. You know where people have a difficult time when they really have gotten themselves... She deals with all the basic fears. The fear of the mysterious noise. That nothing is more fearful, for example, than a disembodied noise. Because, it goes against nature. Everything that goes against nature is generally a feared thing. But I'd like to read to you here, if I may, talking about the fear and the supernatural attitudes towards other races. One of the greatest masters of that genre. He was, and everyone likes to think he was a terrible writer, but let me tell you, he played on the fear organ. He played on this gigantic gothic organ the way E. Powers Biggs plays on a gigantic Westminster 4,000 pipe monster. You know, he really played him all stops. The Vox Heroica. He would play on the Vox Terrory. It was a great, the screaming things. Give me my number two there. Here. Now, listen. Now, hold it there for 1 minute. I'm going to read to you a description of one of the great characters in horror fiction of all time. A description being read by an Englishman who, like the later James Bond, pursued this monster to the four corners of the globe. The Four Corners of Terror. But Smith, this is almost incredible. What perverted genius controls this awful secret world movement? Imagine a person. Tall. Lean. Feline, high-shouldered, with a brow like Shakespeare, and a face like Satan, a close-shaven skull, and long, magnetic eyes of the true cat green. Invest him with all the cruel cunning of an entire Eastern Oriental race, accumulated in one giant intellect, with all the resources of science, past and present, with all the resources, if you will, of a wealthy government, which, however, already has denied all knowledge of his existence. Imagine that awful being. And you have a mental picture of Dr. Fu Manchu, the yellow peril incarnate in one man. All right, now just keep that inside there. We're going to use it again. Just hold it there, Charlie. There you have a picture of all of the fundamentals of the basic fears of everyone. Tall, lean, and feline. Hardly anyone is ever afraid of short people, really. To be feared, you must be thin. It is very rare that any of our basic fears concern fat people. Have you noticed that? It is very rare that our fears are of people with, say, blue eyes. That's another thing. Oh, yes, because we're blue-eyed people, generally. I'm talking about us. I am talking about us. I'm talking about the majority. I cannot speak for the Orientals here, being not an Oriental. However, they probably have blue-eyed villains. But listen to this. Incredibly feline, high shouldered, with a brow like Shakespeare and a face like a saint. A close-shaven skull, long magnetic eyes of the true cat green. Invest him with all the cruel cunning of an entire Eastern race, accumulated in one giant intellect with all the resources of science, past and present. With all the resources, if you will, of a wealthy government, which, however, already has denied all knowledge of his existence. Imagine that awful being. And you have a mental picture of Dr. Fu Manchu, the yellow peril incarnate in one man. Now, see, this makes James Bond greasy kid stuff. It really does. Now, I'm going to show you Dr. Fu Manchu in action. Now, you've just heard a description of this gigantic cat-like intellect, supernatural powers. Oh, one thing he always had, too. He had long fingernails, 3 and 4 inches in length, that were beautifully tended. Great talons, those yellow parchment-like fingers. His skin was always described as transparent, of an indeterminate age. He was always described as a man who could well have been thousands of years old. Perhaps he was. Perhaps he had discovered many centuries ago a secret of eternal life. Indeed, the various magics and arts that he performed had been forgotten by all men thousands of years before. How else would he learn these things? Oh, no. No, you see, that is the reverse of Shangri-La, Charlie. No. You see, because poor James Hilton always assumed that eternal life would make people happy and beautiful. Oh, no. Most people are deeply afraid of the idea of eternal life. Because, no, forget religion. We're talking about something right here and now. No, it's all over the world people are afraid of eternal life. Do you know that in many parts of the globe people are deadly afraid of old people? And in fact destroy them? Because they begin to believe that at a certain point a person becomes evil? That surprises you, doesn't it? I'll also tell you that whenever you think of witches, you think of very old, gnarled people. Why? It's a very, very important point, remember. Whenever you think of gnomes, terrible, evil gnomes, they're not 16-year-old gnomes. You just don't think of clean-limbed Debbie Reynolds witches. You just don't. You always think of gnarled, aged things. Well, there's a secret fear of age. And especially if age goes beyond what is called the normal lifespan. You see, because if a person lives to be 70, that is normal. What if he lives to be 140? Then it becomes supernatural. And people then begin to suspect this person of kind of supernatural evil. They really do. And it's becoming, it always, and throughout most cultures, the idea of eternal life has been associated with indescribable horror. It's only James Hilton or that type will write about it as being eternally beautiful with Ronald Coleman. Now, do you know the works of H. Rider Haggard? Well, he dealt with this theme too, you know. And she which was a sensationally scary book because it dealt with the idea of eternal life, which resulted in eternal evil. See, the idea being here that if a person can live forever, the person has no fear of what they call retribution. If a person has the eternal life gift, he does not fear any such thing as, let us say, a religious comeuppance. If you're going to live forever, you're not going to die. And if you're not going to die, you're not going to go to hell. It gets as simple as that. So he can do anything he wants. That is a secret admission that if you were not going to be punished for your crimes, you would be inevitably evil. Very interesting admission. But leave it to romantic neo-romanticists to believe the other way, that if man lived forever, he would be a beautiful creature. Ah, forget it. Oh, boy. If everyone knew that he was going to be here forever, oh, wow. If he had eternal, oh, wow. Do you want to hear more of Fu Manchu in action? Now, this is a rare passage and one of my favorite passages from one of the early writings of Sax Rohmer. This, as a matter of fact, I don't think has ever been reprinted, and it's from a book called The Mystery of Dr. Fu Manchu, an old book that happens to be an old English penny novel. This is a paperback novel. All right, all set? All right, let's go. Dr. Fu Manchu. Petrie, I dragged you into this. God forgive me. Dry up, Smith, I said slowly. I'm not a child. There's no question of being dragged into the matter. I'm here. And if I can be of any use, I'm glad I am here. He grasped my hand. If there were two Chinese in European clothes. Oh, Lord, how my head throbs in that office there. They sandbagged us, Petrie. Think of it, in broad daylight, within hail of the Strand, we were rushed into the car, and it was all over. God, they gave me an awful knock. Why have we been spared, Smith? Do you think he's... God, no. Do you think he's saving us for... Don't, Petrie. If you had been in China, if you'd seen what I seen. Footsteps sounded in the flag passage. A blade of light crept across the floor towards us. My brain was growing clearer. The place had a damp, earthen smell. It was slimy. A noise from cellar. A door was thrown open, and a man entered, carrying a lantern. Its light showed my surmise to be accurate. Showed the slime-coated walls of a dungeon, some 15 feet square. Shone upon the long yellow robe of the man who stood watching us. Upon the malignant, intellectual countenance. It was... Dr. Fu Manchu. At last, they truly were face to face. The head of the great yellow movement and the man who fought on behalf of the entire white race. How can I paint the individual whom now I had the leisure to study? Perhaps the greatest genius of modern times. Of him, it had been fitly said that he had a brow like Shakespeare, a face like Satan, something serpentine, hypnotic, was in his very presence. Smith drew a sharp breath and was silent. Together, chained to the wall, two medieval captives, living mockeries of our boasted modern security, we crouched before the evil genius, Dr. Fu Manchu. He came forward with an indescribable gait, cat-like, yet strangely awkward, carrying his high shoulders almost hunched. He placed the lantern in a niche in the wall, never turning away the reptilian gaze of those eyes, which must haunt my dreams forever. They possessed a viridescence, which hitherto I had only supposed possible in the eye of the cat. And the film intermittently clouded their brightness. But I can't speak of them anymore. I'd never supposed prior to meeting Dr. Fu Manchu that so intense a force of malignancy could radiate from any human being. He spoke. His English was perfect, though at times his words were oddly chosen. His delivery, ultimately was guttural and sibilant. Dr. Smith. Dr. Petrie. Your interference with my plans has gone too far. I have seriously turned my attention to you. He displayed his teeth. Small and evenly spaced. Evenly separated. And yet discolored in a way that was unfamiliar with me. I studied his eyes with a new professional interest, which even the extremity of danger could not wholly banish. Their greenness seemed to be of the iris. The pupil was oddly contracted, a pinpoint. Smith leaned his back against the wall with an assumed indifference. You have presumed, continued Fu Manchu, to meddle with a world change. Poor spiders caught in the wheels of the inevitable. You have linked my name with the futility of the Young China Movement. The name of Fu Manchu. Mr. Smith, you are an incompetent meddler. I despise you. Dr. Petrie, you are a fool. I am sorry for you. He rested one bony hand on his hip, narrowing the long eyes as he looked down on us. The purposeful cruelty of the man was inherent. It was entirely untheatrical. Smith still remained silent. So, I am forced, and in fact determined to remove you from the scene of your blunders, added Fu Manchu. Opium will soon do the same for you. I rapped at him savagely. Without emotion, he turned his narrowed eyes upon me. That is a matter of opinion, Doctor. Doctor, he said, you may have lacked the opportunities which have been mine for studying that subject, and in any future event, I shall be privileged to enjoy your advice. You will not long outlive me, I replied. And our deaths will not profit you, incidentally, because... Smith's foot touched mine. He was signaling for silence. Because? Inquired Fu Manchu softly. Ah, Mr. Smith was prudent. He is thinking that I have files. He pronounced the word files in a way that made me shudder. Mr. Smith has seen a wire jacket. Have you ever seen a wire jacket? As a surgeon, its function should interest you. A wire jacket. I stifled a cry that rose to my lips, for with a shrill, whistling sound, a small shape came bounding into the dimly lit vault, then shot upward. A marmoset landed on the shoulder of Dr. Fu Manchu and peered grotesquely into the dreadful yellow face. The doctor languidly raised his bony hand and fondled the little creature, crooning to it. One of my pets, Mr. Smith, he said, suddenly opening his eyes fully so that they blazed like green lamps. I have others, equally useful. My scorpions. Have you met my scorpions? No? My pythons. My hamadryads. Then there are my fungi and my tiny allies, the bacilli. I have a collection in my laboratory, quite unique. Have you ever visited Molokai, the leper island, Doctor? No? But Mr. Nayland Smith will be familiar with the asylum at Rangoon, and we must not forget my black spiders with their diamond eyes. My spiders that sit in the dark and watch and then leap. He raised his lean hand so that the sleeve of the robe fell back to the elbow. And the ape dropped chattering to the floor and ran from the cellar. Oh, God of Cathay, he cried. By what death shall these die? These miserable ones who would bind thine empire, which is boundless. Like some priest of Tezcat he stood, his eyes upraised to the roof, his lean body quivering, a sight to shock the most unimpressionable mind. "He's mad," I whispered to Smith. "God help us, the man is a dangerous homicidal maniac." Nayland Smith's face was drawn, but he shook his head grimly. "Dangerous, yes, I agree," he muttered. "His existence is a danger to the entire white race, which now we are powerless to avert." Dr. Fu Manchu recovered himself, took up his lantern, and turned abruptly, walked to the door with his awkward yet feline gait. At the threshold, he looked back. "You have warned Mr. Graham Guthrie," he said in a soft voice. "Tonight at 12:30, Mr. Graham Guthrie dies." Smith sat silent and motionless, his eyes upon the speaker. "You are in Rangoon in 1908, continued Dr. Fu Manchu. "You remember the call?" From somewhere above us, I could not determine the exact direction, came a low, wailing cry, an uncanny thing, a falling cadences, which in that dismal vault, with the sinister yellow-robed figure at the door, seemed to pour ice into my veins. Its effect upon Smith was truly extraordinary. His face showed grayly in the faint light. I heard him draw a hissing breath through clenched teeth. "It calls for you," said Fu Manchu. "At 12:30, it calls for Graham Guthrie." The door closed, and darkness mantled us again. "Smith," I said. "Smith, what was that? Smith, what was that?" The horrors about us were playing havoc with my nerves. It was the call. It was the call. The call of Siva.
"Yes, sir.
Whispered Smith hoarsely. "What is it? Who uttered it? What does it mean?" I don't know what it is, Petrie. Nor who utters it. Means death.
There you go. Oh, boy. How's that for playing upon the... Oh, pulling out all the stops.
The call of Siva.
I've always maintained that James Bond is playing with greasy kid stuff. After once you have tasted Fu Manchu, certainly Dr. No is Ovaltine in a world of heady brandy. Now, do you see the similarity between the two kinds of writing? And I must say, I'm afraid I have to admit that Romer does it better. Oh, he pulls out all the stops. Boy, I'll tell you, there is a scene. I wish I... Oh, here. Do you want to hear another one? Listen to this one. Listen to this... This will only take a few seconds. A description of Dr. Fu Manchu's evil fungi cellars. Yes. Yes, I know what time we've got. Don't worry. Listen to this. Just one little description. Oh, no, I can't. Not at this hour. Not a couple of minutes before midnight. I mean, here's the scene. I mean, do you know, this guy didn't fool around like shooting people. You know what he did? You know what mold is? Don't worry, I know where I am, Charlie. Do you know what mold is? Do you know what mold does? Do you know that mold really are tiny plants that devour, say, bread, or even devour, say, deceased bodies? Well, Dr. Fu Manchu had developed a strain of man-eating mold. How's that for putting you away? Because the beauty of it all is that the mold had a particular type of digestive process that enabled them to digest things, leaving not a trace.
And this mold, like all mold, lived in dank, dark cellars and created and generated a Stygian, strange, dark, thick, sweetish-smelling heat. Graham Guthrie, C. Nayland Smith were hurled down a long, greased chute into this dark cellar. Oh, another thing about man-eating mold. This mold, because it was a large, unknown kind of mold, was so large that its digestive processes and its light and life processes could be heard in the darkness. A strange, snickering sound. A gurgling sound, if you will. The sound of ancient winds blowing through the eternal, life, spore-like bodies of the terrible, terrible green man-eating fungi. Yes, now these are the deep, sacred, these are the true deep, secret fears that we all have. Creeping, disembodied hands. The sound of thumps in unthumpable places. The fear of other races. High cheekbones, feline green eyes, brows like Shakespeare, close-shaven skulls.